Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 22nd of February, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. We're delighted to be joined by David Scott from North of the Border with Northern Exposure and David Ellis, Strategic Defence Initiatives. Those of a weak disposition.
Well, just say apologies for the slight technical hitch just there. A couple of people noticed the timer stuck at zero, but we got there in the end. Yes, weak disposition. Look away now because, well, let's welcome David Scott to the programme and say Hollywood magazine, Tony Blair, just at the point where we're seeing a new centrist party rise to take over British politics forever. And of course, it's his initiative. He's put money into it and he's suddenly being promoted in the sort of, what is this, the main Scottish political organ?
Well, this is the coincidental nature of this front page. This is, we don't actually know what the article says yet. It's published on Monday. Can't wait to read this one. This is the official house organ of Holyrood, the Parliament. Right, where they talk about things and in a non-political way, they take the higher ground. And well, it's time for reflection from Tony. So yeah, things are not going as planned. I think that's one of the admissions on display here, and we need Tony to fix things.
Well, you're not wrong. Now, Tony, of course, has been appearing in various places, not least in Germany. And if you were watching the UK column or my Twitter feed yesterday, you would have seen as pushing out some information about Tony Blair and what he was saying with regard to EU military. Well, let's just say he was speaking at the Technical University of Munich on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. Let's just briefly hear what he had to say.
So, you see, the European defence concept actually was started by a summit between myself and President Chirac back in the year 2000.
Well, in fact, he's not quite correct about that because the summit took place in December 1998. But nonetheless, this was the Saint-Malo summit, which basically kicked off this most recent effort to push through military unification in Europe. But he didn't end there. He had a couple of other things to say, and you need to listen a little bit carefully to the language here.
If we explain this properly, no, it doesn't help the Brexit case. I came to the conclusion that though this transatlantic alliance with America is extremely important and we need to maintain it, the best partnership is a partnership where we have our own capabilities that are also strong. And this is why I think the concept of European defence and greater European defence cooperation is absolutely essential.
So he had been asked, was the discussion in on the European mainland and affecting the Brexit campaign? In other words, were the Brexit campaign getting some advantage by that discussion? And he's saying, well, actually, if this entire process is explained properly to people, then there's no reason that it should give any momentum to the Brexit campaign. But it was the use of the word "our." Once again, he's talking about our defence. So I just wanted to remind everybody what we were talking about on Monday with Gavin Williamson, because he was talking about having met Ursula von der Leyen at NATO earlier in the week, and that Europeans should not be spending 2% GDP on defence for America. We should be spending it for ourselves and our security. So Gavin Williamson reflecting Tony Blair's language there, and not just in the use of the word "our" and "ourselves," of course, because Tony Blair's point in that little video clip there was that while the transatlantic relationship is very important, it's much more important to build a European structure. And this is exactly what Gavin Williamson is presenting here. He had been to NATO with Ursula von der Leyen. He's saying that Europeans should not be spending 2% of GDP on defence for America. As Brian pointed out already, of course, the Europeans have never spent any GDP on defence for America. It's been quite the opposite way. So what he's really pointing out, or what he's saying there, is that exactly what Tony Blair was saying. While NATO's important, actually European defence is much more important. And I just remind you also that, of course, Jeremy Hunt, speaking to the Adnar Stiftung had been saying this: a future partnership that Britain seeks to build with the EU starts with the belief that our security is indivisible. So, David Ellis, welcome to the programme. Basically, our point yesterday on Twitter, and what we really want to encourage people, the reason we want to encourage people to push this so hard on Twitter, is that the Tory party seems to be pursuing a Blairite policy, and I'm not clear how a Blairite policy became Tory policy.
Absolutely, that's exactly the case. They are implementing and pursuing a, in Tony Blair's own words, essential project and concept of EU defence union. And there's the key thing, isn't it? Now this really does sort of shed a bit of light onto why we've got this political denotice within the Tory party not to discuss this at any level. So we can see why. You've got Tony Blair there in his own inimitable words claiming ownership of initiating the concept and essential policy of EU defence union. So he's fell short of some of the sort of key the key phrasing there in his own inimitable way of the way that he speaks. But it's very clear from the clip as a whole that he knows exactly what this is and what it's going to do, and that the co-op and partnership language that we've seen Theresa May using continually and the cabinet using is really Tony Blair's language, or the language of the EU. So we've got the stumbling block here, haven't we? We've got really the final bit of the jigsaw that we can now see the full picture. And everybody here, I hope, will now get behind this, knowing full well that Tony Blair has got a considerable hidden hand in this entire operation. So the key part there is that he's saying we have to be very careful about the way that it's handled and explained. Well, of course, at the moment, it isn't really being explained at all. So this is the key part, because what he's saying is if it was explained properly, it would have an effect on the Brexit case, i.e. it would have an effect on the Leave case. So he's trying to bolster the position to remain by holding it out of the debate. So what we all need to do at this stage is get onto your MP, and particularly if they're a Conservative MP, and put to them directly as in the strongest possible terms, whether you telephone their office or whether you write to them or you email or whether you know, whatever you way you want to interact on Twitter, whatever, you know, why are Tory ministers implementing an essential Tony Blair policy of implementing EU defence union? And this is the contradiction that we've now got. No MP would be able to sit and retain their seat if they didn't support openly Her Majesty's Armed Services.
Yep.
They would not be able to retain their seat. So this is the key thing. So we've got MPs here sitting in silence, effectively walking away from Her Majesty's Armed Services, from British Armed Forces, because by allowing this to continue, we lose them. So it would be an untenable position for any MP to say, I no longer support Her Majesty's Armed Services. We're going to put them into defence union.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be able to sit. They would be finished. They'd have to resign, frankly, yeah, because they'd be so much of a public outcry and a whiplash.
David, you're being very passionate about this. And of course, quite rightly, I think we need to be bullish here and say that over the last 24 hours, the UK column has tweeted out all the information that people need. We've tweeted out the video clips of what Tony Blair's been saying with a brief Twitter type analysis of what he's saying. We've pointed out the danger. We've warned that this isn't just about the British Army. This is about tri-service and the nukes and defence procurement, defence industry, all going into the EU. Well, in fact, remaining, because it's already been signed over. So on our Twitter page, we have already given all of the information which people need. And what they need to be doing is taking that material and ramming it under the noses of their local MPs and pushing it into the local constituency offices. We're at a very dangerous point here, but I think we have to say that we, you have been part of that team as well, have pushed this information out.
Right, and I just want to also remind people why this issue is effectively a done deal, because prior to the referendum, we'll remind you once again that prior to the referendum, David Cameron, who was Prime Minister at the time, toured European heads of state to try to arrange his side of the referendum, which was to stay in the European Union within a reformed European Union. So, in other words, he was renegotiating the future relationship with between the UK and the EU, pretty much where we seem to be at the moment, in fact, right at the beginning of a negotiation on our future relationship. But back in 2015, when Jean-Claude Juncker was really pushing for what he was describing as an EU army at that time, making multiple statements during 2015, he also said this, that military union is a condition of any future relationship with the UK. So in other words, this is why this issue is not being discussed as, well, it's one of the reasons why this issue is not being discussed as part of the Brexit debate, because this is already a done deal and was probably a done deal since 2015 when Juncker was making these statements, or certainly since 2016 when David Cameron was touring the European heads of state. So David Ellis, just very, very briefly on this, the fact that this is not part of the discussion, this is the key thing that we've got to get into the public domain and get this part of the Brexit debate.
It's absolutely key to the whole point of leaving. You cannot seriously sell to the British public in secrecy, in effect, because that's what they're doing, that our military remains while we have this foe, this facade of leaving. It's a lie, because we're not leaving. It's an utter joke for that to be allowed to continue, but the political interface are carrying on with it because the Tories are complicit. They've clearly gone along with it. We know from the prime source there of Admiral Lord Boyce, Knight of the Garter, at the start of Brexit, said to me that none of this was included in the Brexit frame. Now, we now know why, because there must have been some sort of co-op with the Remain side of Blair and Cameron to hold this out from the public. So being the whole nation is being deceived on a level unprecedented.
Yeah. Yes. OK, well, look, we got to leave that subject there for now. So let's move on. And we're heading over to Israel. David, I think it was last Friday you were talking about the Visegrad summit and the whole issue of the row with Poland. Well, it appears to have been cancelled.
Yes, because, well, the Israelis have had a bit of a diplomatic, what would you call it? I don't think the word's quite been invented. So Bibi Netanyahu had too much responsibility in one person. He was acting as foreign minister, finance minister, prime minister. It was basically a one-man parliament. Legal action was taken to stop him doing this. In the face of this oncoming legal action, he decided to appoint a foreign minister, a Mr. Katz, who the same day that he was appointed said the following: "I am the son of Holocaust survivors. We will never forgive and never forget." And there were many Poles who collaborated with the Nazis. And he then quoted former Prime Minister Shamir. Shamir said that every Pole suckled anti-Semitism with his mother's milk. Nobody will tell us how to express our stance and how to honour the dead. So there you see collective judgment about people who were not born at the time being applied in an openly racist manner against the Poles in this case. And, you know, as an entry into international diplomacy, that didn't go down too well with the Poles.
No, I would imagine it wouldn't. It went on. I have no problem with someone mentioning the fact that during the cruel, evil, dehumanising war, there were individual criminals in my nation Obviously, there were, just as in any other nation, this was the Polish response. But when you use these stereotypes that every Pole suckled anti-Semitism out of their mother's breast, it's nothing short of racism. So he's absolutely pushing that point, David.
Yes, he's calling it for what it is. And then he withdrew from a summit that was being organised and held in Jerusalem. And this was four European nations who were meeting in Jerusalem. And it was a major diplomatic breakthrough, this, because here you're seeing Jerusalem being used for summits. So Jerusalem's importance goes up. Jerusalem is being de facto recognized as the capital of Israel. And you're seeing common cause being sought by the Netanyahu government and governments in Europe who would be opposed to Islamic immigration, for example. So this was a very important point and a very important diplomatic position that the Netanyahu government had taken. And due to appointing someone who was totally incompetent and ran his mouth off, it's now all been thrown away, because the narrative, which is the Holocaust trumps everything, that is increasingly taking over in Jewishness, and this is a point that Atzmon talks about, is actually derailing real events now. So that's one to watch.
Okay, well, look, let's move on to Ukraine, because on Wednesday, I think it was, there was UN General Assembly debate on Ukraine, and basically this came about because on the 12th of February, the Russians had initiated a UN Security Council meeting on the situation in Ukraine. It was the fourth anniversary of the signing of the Minsk agreements, basically, and so they asked for a UN Security Council meeting. And the West wasn't so happy about the idea of that, so they organised a counter meeting in the General Assembly, which was held on Wednesday. And this was dedicated apparently to the fifth anniversary of Russian aggression against Ukraine, because, you know, that's the key narrative here. Well, let's just have a look at, you can see some of the Foreign Office propaganda that was pushed out on this morning. This is Jonathan Cohen, the US ambassador to the UN, saying the international community should remain united in support of Ukraine and impose costs on Russia for these attempts to undermine Ukraine. Karen Pierce had to get in on the act as well. She said the forcible Russian seizure of 10,000 square miles from Ukraine broke the first principle of international law. The countries may not acquire territory or change borders by force. It also violated a number of international agreements and commitments, including Article 2 of the UN Charter, the Helsinki Final Act, the Budapest Memorandum, and the 1997 Russia-Ukraine Treaty of Friendship. The United Kingdom is also deeply concerned by the ongoing militarization of Crimea and the Sea of Azov by the Russian Federation. Now, of course, she's talking about the bridge that Russia has built across the Sea of Azov and the fact that they're controlling access to the Sea of Azov at the moment. But while all this nonsense was going on Wednesday in the United Nations, Vladimir Putin, of course, was giving his sort of state of the nation. And he's talking about all kinds of things, including the essential, it being essential to have a strong economy. And he was saying how great it was that they'd built the railway section of the Crimean Bridge. It's a powerful economic impetus, is what he was saying. Of course, he also said that Russia was and would remain an independent sovereign state.
We don't approve of independent sovereign state.
Now, of course, that little short clip there is from H.G. Wells' The Shape of Things to Come, which is an absolute fantastic sort of British propaganda piece. I recommend everybody watches it. It's quite utopian, but anyway, they don't approve of, or we don't approve of, independent sovereign states. David Scott, first of all, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this continuing sort of rhetoric against Russia and more Russia's response to it, which continues to be, to hell with you guys, we're going to continue to do our own thing.
Yes, but the Russian response is rational, and the volume of the saber rattling is going up. As Donald Tusk went and did a major speech during the week, in Rada, right? Now, he said, quote, there is no Europe without the Ukraine. And by the way, there's no Ukraine without Crimea, right? So you see the case for war is being made. Now, he's not quite talking military action yet, but the ideological case has been made. I find that really concerning.
This is Ukraine. This is the grain. This is oil. This is Theresa May's Operation Barbarossa.
Absolutely, David Ellis.
It's exactly Barbarossa Mark, whatever it is now. I don't know, since Napoleon tried it, Hitler tried it. And now you can see this gearing now. It's a huge amount of pretext to war, even from the top secret cabinet office papers and a gousier that we've just recovered from Q, are very centred in 1948 onto the defence union trajectory on the basis of Russia. So whatever's been going on there is a long-term problem. Russia clearly wants to still be a nation, as Mr. Putin is saying, and let's say we can rely on what he's saying as that's the case. And, of course, we're back to really, you know, what are we really back to? You know, there isn't really scope for a land war. I don't think that'll work because the carnage and the bodies will be immense. Are we back to Truman's clean sweep where he wanted to just simply carpet bomb Russia with nuclear devices? Or are we into something else? But Putin has alluded to these new drone underwater cruise missiles that he's got, or the cruise missile in effect that's underwater. There's a substantial nuclear warhead on the end of it that will literally just, once it's delivered into the water, it will go and find an American aircraft carrier, or anybody's aircraft carrier for that matter, go and find it and sink it. It doesn't have to hit it, it just has to get next to it and detonate. So really what we're seeing here is a huge shift in global positioning. With that one move with these underwater nuclear drones, it really has to beg the question, and this is an if, and I'm asking the question, does it render the American aircraft carrier fleet and the British aircraft, the two new British aircraft carriers, redundant? And if that is the case, what effect will that have on the petrodollar, the dollar oil dollar relationship? So there are huge consequences going to happen here as a result of it. And we're going to see it unfold relatively quickly. I'd like to say just one thing in closing, because we're getting a lot of feedback upon religious issues and immigration issues as to why we're pushing the military angle and not going with the religion or the immigration issues. So I'd just like to say to everybody on that issue that free movement of people is actually free movement of money. And anybody that's campaigning on a basis of religion politically is in the wrong area totally. You cannot make windows of people's souls, but what you can do is focus on something which will sway a majority of people in Britain, which is supporting a national military, Her Majesty's Armed Forces, to remain as they are now, as we understand them, and not go into military union. Because the only thing I can see, my opinion at the moment of forecast, is the only thing military union is going to do is attack Russia.
Yeah.
Now, hands up, who wants to do that?
Well, that's a good point. I don't think anybody would want to see that at all. Now, just quickly, David Scott, the EU League of Arab States summit is taking place 24th to 25th in Sharm el Sheikh. So give us a little bit of background to this.
Well, yeah, I'm glad the running order came up in that particular sequence, because David Ellis isn't quite right. There's two things. There's two areas of interest to the EU unified military. There's the eastern neighbourhood, which means conflict with Russia, and there's the southern neighbourhood, which means rebuilding essentially the Roman Empire along the banks of the Mediterranean. That's the Levant and North Africa. And there's a major summit. Again, there's not been much trumpeting of this in the press, but there's a major summit coming up at the weekend. And we're being represented, you'll be pleased to know, by Donald Tusk, the same man who was declaring his support for everything Ukrainian, is out there to have a chat with the Arabs and discuss Arab-European ties. multilateralism, quite sure what that means in this context. Migration, well, we know all about that. Security, well, yes, there'll definitely be discussions of security. And trade and investment. So we're talking about high level, big deals over oil. We're talking about major geopolitical moves by the European Union to establish and essentially to replace the United States in the Arab world. This is not small.
Okay. Now, moving back to the UK then, of course, around the Christmas time, we had major trouble in British airports caused by drones. Well, everybody would be pleased to know that we're going to deal with that problem by setting up a competition. This is finding and neutralising small drones. So this is the Defence and Security Accelerator. And they're saying that the introduction of unmanned air systems is often referred to as drones, has been one of the most significant technological advances of recent years and represents a shift in capability of potential adversaries. The threat from unmanned aerial vehicles has evolved rapidly, and we are seeing the use of hostile improvised drone threats in overseas theatres of operation. There is a similar problem in the UK, with malicious or accidental use of drones becoming a security challenge at events affecting critical infrastructure and public establishments, including prisons and major UK airports. So they've launched this competition. They're looking to aiming to harness recent technology advances in a range of areas such as sensing technologies, autonomy, artificial intelligence and non-lethal effectors to improve the ability of the UK defence and security community to counter an adversary's use of drones. This needs to be achieved while preventing or minimising collateral damage. So that's fantastic stuff. The solutions could include automated and networked sensing systems, cost-effective sensors, plug-and-play compliant integration. This is really fantastic stuff. Methods of robustly defeating and denying current and next generation drones in a range of scenarios and environments, significant and rapid improvements to extant systems for deployment, and autonomous decision making. So, we couldn't do much better than that.
Well, we can, I'm delighted to say, because the government has announced it's going to give medals to people who've been flying the Predator drones. I put out a UK column tweet, kiss the wife, hug the children, leave home, remotely fly a Reaper drone at no risk to you whatsoever. Kill and maim some people you've never seen who you were told by the UK government are bad. Have a cup of tea, leave the base, go home to wife, get a medal, sick. And only one person tried to challenge me over that, and I pointed out it'd be roughly equivalent of me getting a Northern Ireland medal for sitting in a minesweeper off the coast of Northern Ireland while the troops were ashore having to face real hardship. So pretty sickening, but presumably they won't be giving medals if you're flying your toy drone.
But in fairness, it is a medal without a clasp, so I presume that's not quite as significant a medal as other medals.
Mm, yeah, that's the point though, yeah, Mike.
I know,
really.
I totally agree. But anyway, it gets better because, well, Britain is going to be the heart of future AI development because the government is piling money into training at universities for the next generation of artificial intelligence talent. This is new postgraduate artificial intelligence qualifications. So it's going to be an industry-funded AI master's with 16 dedicated centres at universities across the country to train the next generation of AI PhDs. And the Alan Turing Institute AI Research Fellowships are now open, so that's fantastic stuff. It's going to be up to 200 new AI master's places at UK universities funded by companies such as DeepMind, Quantum Black, Cisco and BAE Systems. And the master's program apparently marks the first nationwide effort to address the skills gap at this level. 1,000 students will have the opportunity to enhance their skills with new PhDs at 16 dedicated centres, and up to 5 AI research fellowships are going to be created in collaboration with the Alan Turing Institute to both attract and retain the best research talent from around the world. Ah, so it's not necessarily for British citizens. It could be for anybody from any country.
Great.
Good stuff. Well, we shouldn't forget what Jeremy Wright said about this. The UK is not only the birthplace and father to artificial intelligence, Alan Turing, but we are leading the way on work to ensure AI innovation has ethics at its core. Yes. David Scott, have you seen any evidence in recent weeks, months or years that ethics is being considered as important at the core of AI development?
They shouldn't use big words they don't understand. Ethics. Now, this would be situational ethics. This would be, give me a reason why it's okay to bomb the wedding. Yeah, I'm sure those sort of ethics will be at the core. It's just not the ethics that the man in the Clapham omnibus would recognise.
Oh, well, indeed. Okay, a couple of brief advertisements. If you like what we do here at the UK Column and you'd like to support us, please join. You can do that at ukcolumn.org/community. And another reminder that AV9.1 DVDs are available on the UK Column website. And to remind everybody as well that I believe there are less than 10 residential places left for AV10 in May. If anybody wants to go to that, you probably need to do it pretty quickly. Details at alternativeview.co.uk.
Okay, and a reminder that the 5G smart meter technology and the impact on our health talk is on at the Town Hall, Buckfastleigh, Devon this evening at 7:30. So if you're local and can make that, please come along. But I also think the attendance to that is going to be very good.
And Ian R. Crane speaking of that event, at that event as well, of course.
Right.
Right. Now, responding to cognitive security challenges. This is a new report out from NATO, from NATO's Strategic Communications Centre of Excellence. And they have been carrying out a study on digital matters and the risks that digital matters may be posing to serving military personnel. So the report, as you can see there, is titled Responding to Cognitive Security Challenges. And they're concerned about a malicious actor who might be trolling social media and picking up information about people that are taking part in military exercises. And so what they're asking is, what can we find out about a military exercise just from open source data? What can we find out about participants from open source data? And can we use that data to influence the participants' behaviours against their given orders? They're saying that they weren't going to disclose any details of how they carried out the study for operational security reasons, but they had created fake Twitter accounts and fake closed Facebook groups. They then went on to try to befriend anybody that was taking part in some kind of armed exercise or armed forces exercise on these social media platforms. And they said that by the end of the study, they'd managed to identify 150 service members, find the locations of several battalions, as well as track troop movements and instill desirable behaviour in these troops. So they were able to actually influence the behaviour of these people taking part in these exercises, they said. And they said the results suggest that in the current digital arena, an adversary would be able to collect enough personal data on soldiers to create targeted messages with precision, successfully influencing their chosen target audience to carry out desired behaviours. Now, I can't work out, Brian, quite what this is about. Is it about persuading us that Vladimir Putin is not only influencing our elections and our social media our news agenda, but he's now actually helping to run various military exercises? Or is this just simply an attempt to provide another excuse to shut down social media in some?
Yeah, I think it's the latter, Mike. I think that they're worried that, of course, serving members of the armed forces are looking at all sorts of information because they also don't believe what the BBC has put out. And this is now being realised as a problem. So you were serving overseas in Afghanistan, for instance, but if you were able to get onto the internet, you could see other news sources reporting what Afghanistan was about. Mm. British government very frightened. We'll just drop this one in quickly, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but the Register here reporting that somebody stole 77 Brigade, which is the Army's special social media influence unit. They stole their Twitter account. You found this one, David. I did find it quite enjoyable. The Ministry of Defence denied that 77 Brigade had a Twitter account. They don't have one, they said, but clearly there was one. So maybe the Ministry of Defence wasn't aware that 77 Brigade had a Twitter account, or they were running a non-mod approved Twitter account. It's tweets.
Yeah, Well, I had a little look for them, and there is a Twitter account, but it's protected at the moment. I don't know if that's cause and effect. Yeah, but some bloke seems to have got in there, and if that's the case, it doesn't suggest that 77th Brigade are as tech savvy as we might have been led to believe.
Well, we don't need to worry because Disinfo Week is coming, and this is Disinfo Week Europe. It's being run by the Atlantic Council. It's coming on March the 4th to 8th. There's three different events, one in Athens, one in Madrid, and one in Brussels. And you'll be glad to know that Damien Collins, the chairman of the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, will be taking part on that. Now, of course, last week he released the DCMS report on disinformation and what he thought should be done about it. And he said that our inquiry over the last year has identified three big threats to society. The challenge for the year ahead is to start to fix them. We cannot delay any longer. So in order to avoid delaying any longer, he's taking part in this event. And the panel that he's on is entitled To Regulate or Not Regulate. And it says that since allegations emerged that malicious state and non-state actors and Russia in particular had used social media platforms to influence US and European elections, governments have been slow to respond. Now, after more than 2 years, the platform's efforts at self-regulation have been proven insufficient in tackling the problem. It is time for the governments to step in and is it time for governments to step in and regulate the platforms? Experts will debate. Well, he will be joined by Alina Polikova, who's from the David M. Rubenstein a David M. Rubenstein Fellow for Foreign Policy at Brookings Institute. She'll be speaking with him. And also Jens Henrik Jeppesen, who's Representative and Director for European Affairs at the Centre for Democracy and Technology. So, well, there we go. Disinformation is still absolutely right at the forefront of everything that's going on.
Right at the forefront, but they do have a little problem because they're very keen to introduce a tax, the digital services tax, which I understand will be 2%, and it will include social media platforms. So I think we're going to see a little bit of a war between the people who want to raise money on the social media platforms and the people who want to shut the social media platforms down.
Yes.
More chaos in government.
Where does that take us? Okay.
Scotland.
Scotland, David, and... well, Stephen Sutherland, in fact.
Oh, yes. This was a series of articles in the mainstream Scottish press, in the Daily Record, on Monday, and quite a stunning series of articles it is, too. So here we see, in this first one here, a horrendous story, where a mum of two... She was drugged and she was raped, and she was subsequently bullied and threatened by the rapists. And this drove her to take her own life. And it's just horrendous. Now, the mother of this young woman has identified one of the rapists as the very same person that we were reporting on as the person of interest in the Stephen Sutherland murder. And This is now common knowledge in Caithness. It's now becoming much more common knowledge across Scotland. The Daily Record did an editorial on this, and they commented that for the rule of law to prevail, it must retain the faith of the people for whom it exists to serve and protect. In one corner of Scotland, at least two grieving families have lost that belief. Now, we know that in many corners of many parts of the United Kingdom, there are many families who have lost that belief, but this is amongst the most striking examples. And the journalist who covered this, Marcello Mega of the Daily Record, interviewed Stephen's family, and his father said that we've been told in recent times that the suspect, we called him witness D, because the police had him down as a witness. We've been told in recent times that he has been boasting about getting away with Stephen's murder. I'm told he threatens people that he killed Stephen and got away with it, so he could kill them too. My heart goes out to Jenna and her family, because if the police up here had been even halfway competent, he would have been in prison and Jenna would have been alive. That was Sandy Sutherland. The only thing I would disagree there with is perhaps it's not a matter of competence. Perhaps there's something else driving this entirely. I'd encourage people to look at our article from 2017, Stephen Sutherland, The Unanswered Questions. This outlines the concerns about the case, which are grievous and which remain 2 years on unanswered.
And this is the key issue here, David. This has been going on for 2 years and no progress from the Scottish side at all?
No progress, no. There's talks of investigations and there's talks of fresh looks and then nothing happens.
Yeah.
And the degree, there are many more suspicious deaths this year, only in February, in Caithness. The degree to which that community is under siege, the degree to which it is being completely failed by Police Scotland is something that I would never have expected to see in my own country. And no one's listening. The politicians aren't listening. No one's listening to the people who are crying out in pain and anguish over their lost loved ones. Mm.
Okay. Did you have anything to add?
Well, only that this business that it's not one case, it's multiple cases, and this leads us to believe it's not incompetence on behalf of the police and the Crown Prosecution Service. This is deliberate cover-up.
Mm. Right. OK, David, we're pretty much out of time, but let's just cover this one briefly. Pope calls for concrete measures as summit on clergy sexual abuse begins.
Now, the reason I always want to highlight this is they're having a several-day summit on the horrendous abuse within the Roman Catholic clergy of children. The Royal Commission in Australia estimated that 7% of the entire Roman Catholic clergy, 16, were guilty of sexually abusing, molesting children. There have been hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of cases all around the globe, America and Ireland being two examples. And we know from Scotland and the work with the Fresh Start Foundation and the extremely brave Mr. Pat McEwen, who's spoken out about the abuse he suffered, that it was happening here. If you look at the Maris community in Ayrshire, it's happening in Scotland. It's happening in Scotland with links to Ireland. The links are through the church. So we'll be looking for these words of concrete action to actually come to something. And we'll be speaking to the rulers of the Roman Catholic Church in Scotland to see what, if anything, this actually means.
Okay.
Thank you very much for that. And we'll just end on the note of saying to our viewers and listeners that we put out the information we do to inform and educate people about what's happening with analysis. What we'd like you to do is to be sharing that information and spreading it. It's very clear to UK Column that there is some form of covert censorship now creeping through. It is affecting anybody who is putting out any quality information challenging the government. And if we're to stop or at least get around this insidious censorship, then we need your help to actually re-promulgate the information that we're pushing out. You can email it, you can talk about it, you can copy it, you can push it out in tweets. But it's vital this information goes out. As David Ellis said, our armed forces, as just one example, have been given to the European Union. And Mr. Blair would have silence over that in order to further deceive voters. It's up to all of us to get that information out. That's it for today. David, thank you very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.